Thanks, everyone, for attending today's session. To sort of give you an idea of where we're at, I guess, in the progress we're hoping to make, you can see it says social/digital media, and that reflects my own lack of understanding of what digital and social media are. I think we're going to scratch social and just go with digital. That's the umbrella term, right? Okay. These are our experts, all right. Okay. So, as you know, and you'll hear from the speakers today, digital media is the most rapidly growing form of communication in the world. It's not only a wonderful communication tool, but it's also has fantastic potential as a research tool. And of special interest to this session is its potential for use in qualitative data collection, especially for use in establishing content validity for COAs used in the context of labeling. But despite this tremendous potential of the use of digital tools for this purpose, we really haven't come very far yet, especially in this context. And the genesis of this session is a strong interest on the part of the participants, that's all of us, in understanding how we can actually move this whole process forward. So we're hoping that one of the outcomes of today's session will be the having a better sense of the empirical evidence that we need to overcome whatever hurdles exist to using this to its full potential. Being technologically challenged, I will. Aha. So the disclaimer you've already seen. The session objectives are pretty basic. The first one was that we wanted to help everyone, including me, gain greater understanding of the techniques used to conduct qualitative research using digital media. And we really felt, for the most part, that we had to go outside of healthcare to do this. So we also want to provide examples of implementations that have been taking place within a very select group. We want to discuss the advantages and disadvantages of using digital media to collect these data from the perspective of the regulator and from the perspective of industry. And again, consider how we can move this process forward. So let me introduce you to the session participants. We are very, very pleased to have Trina Paulus here with us. Trina, is an associate professor and coordinator of the Graduate Certificate in Qualitative Research Methods at the Department of Educational Psychology at the University of Tennessee, and she has written a book on this topic. Paul Wicks, Vice President of Innovation at Patients Like Me. Both Trina and Paul will be giving presentations. And then for our panel, we have Electra Papadopoulos from the FDA, who will respond from the industry from the FDA perspective, and Tara Simons from Pfizer, who will respond from the industry perspective. And I also have to say a special thanks to Tara, who agreed to do this at the last minute. So I turn it over to you, Trina.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today, especially since I had to flee the new tornado alley of the South in order to get here, but I'm here safe and sound. I also ask you to forgive me in advance for any faux pas I may commit. I feel like a party crasher at the PRO Consortium, but so far it's been a very interesting party to attend. I bring greetings from the world of educational research, where I've been involved for the past 10 years in looking at how people use new technologies to communicate. I also train graduate students in how these tools can not only be used in the classroom, but also to help us better understand social life. My talk today will touch on some points that my co-authors and I originally made in our recent book from Sage, Digital Tools for Qualitative Research. We wrote this book because we couldn't find a good resource to help our students understand how new technologies impact the entire qualitative research process, from literature reviews to representing our findings in innovative ways that reach a broader audience than just other academics. I will focus today on the use of online tools, including social media, for qualitative data collection. In doing so, I'll draw on my own research experiences in education, as well as my understanding as to how some of these tools are already being used by researchers in health-related fields. I understand that the impetus for today's workshop session comes from a desire to be both more efficient and effective in PRO instrument development. In educational research, too, we look to technological innovations to help us in our work. New tools can support us in reaching new populations for learning, as well as for our research studies, in staying connected with our learners and participants, and in providing and receiving high-quality feedback on their progress. Many, if not most, of our social interactions today take place through social media and through our mobile devices. So it's becoming increasingly important for us to meet our participants where they already are, online. While I have not yet seen in the literature any specific examples of how new technologies are being used for concept elicitation or cognitive debriefing specifically, I will share some examples of how the tools are being used in health-related research in general, and hopefully these will help you spark some ideas for how it may connect with your own work. Recent findings from the Pew Research Center emphasize how important it is for those in the healthcare professions to connect with people online. 72% of adult internet users search for health information online, a quarter are part of online communities with a focus on medical issues, and 16% go online specifically to connect with others with similar health concerns. Even older internet users go online on a daily basis, with 71% of those age 65 and older going online every day. So, not only are a majority of adults of all ages already online, but they are online talking about health concerns, and in my world, they are online to learn. We can leverage this fact to help us reach our potential research participants. In our book, we make the distinction between researcher-generated data and naturally occurring data. Researcher-generated data is what most of us are familiar with: focus groups, interviews, surveys, methods which were in use long before the internet came around. Researcher-generated data is that which would not exist without us going out and creating it. Naturally occurring data, in contrast, is already there in the world and passes what some refer to as the dead social scientist test. It would be there whether we were around or not. Naturally occurring data consists of conversations, activities, and documents generated by people as they go about their daily lives. In 2014, this includes, in a big way, social media interactions. The internet has impacted both kinds of data, providing both new tools and new contexts to explore. I'll discuss three of these today: online interviews and focus groups, online communities and social media, and mobile devices. I'll discuss the tools in chronological order, from the earliest innovations, online interviews and focus groups, which have been around since at least the 2000s, to the most recent, the use of mobile devices such as smartphones for providing prompts, sensor data, and even mobile interviewing. While online communities in the form of Usenet groups and discussion forums have been around since the 1990s, it has really been the rise of social media sites such as Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, LinkedIn, in conjunction with the ubiquity of smartphones and new analytic tools, that these communities have become a powerful source of qualitative big data, providing insights into our social worlds. First, online interviews and focus groups. When we think about how internet technologies can be used to support interviewing and focus group methods, one important distinction to make is between asynchronous and synchronous technologies. Asynchronous tools are used for interaction between people who are not in the same place, nor are they interacting in real time. Tools include email, discussion boards, and some uses of social media, such as commenting on a Facebook post or sending a message to someone through LinkedIn. Tweets and similar social media interactions that take place via mobile devices challenge this dichotomy, as people are often interacting in real time, even though messages that are sent but not immediately received will be stored for later viewing. Synchronous interactions are those that occur between people who are not in the same place, but they are logged in at the same time. The telephone, of course, and texting fall into this category. Facebook chat and other instant messaging programs like Yahoo Messenger, Skype, or Google Hangout are tools that can be used for this kind of interaction. Synchronous interactions can be only text-based, or they can include a two-way audio and even video component. Tools like Skype now allow you to leave a recorded video message, which again blurs that boundary between asynchronous and synchronous technologies by pushing asynchronous technology back into asynchronous form. This screenshot is an example of the kind of tool that could be used for an asynchronous interview or focus group. It's a discussion board. This particular discussion thread is not from an actual research data collection event, because that's all too private to share publicly here. So I took a discussion thread from whiteblaze.net, a public online hobby group for Appalachian Trail thru-hikers. While not created for research purposes, it does show the threaded nature of these discussions. You can see the branching diagram in the top panel, if I can, right there, which shows the posts in chronological order. The initial post that kicked off this threaded discussion about type 2 diabetes on the trail is in the middle panel. And it says, "Hello, I am Mosey Along. I plan to hike in 2014. No experience. There have been some threads about type 2 diabetes. The website says that whole food chromium will fix it in a matter of months. It's not a disease, but a condition with a web link. Looking forward to the trail and meeting many of you." This post does receive a lot of responses, the first of which you will see below. To conduct interviews or focus groups in this manner, where you would design such a tool, would require you to set up a similar kind of discussion forum and initiate and moderate the relevant conversations. A relatively recent, 2009, wasn't so recent, on the use of asynchronous focus group discussions was described by Tate and colleagues as they sought to collect data from hard-to-include populations in the context of pediatric oncology. They noted the cost and time savings as this tool eliminated the need for travel. As all data is generated in textual form, no transcribing is needed, thus reducing transcription bias. Participants who may be reluctant to disclose personal information face-to-face may be more inclined to do so from the comfort of their own computer. And the lack of time pressure for an immediate response can result in more thoughtful and reflective responses. Drawbacks to this type of data collection can include selection bias and non-representativeness due to digital divide issues. Another challenge is how to deal with lurkers, those who may read the contributions to the discussion but not necessarily write or respond. Finally, while the lack of visual cues in this environment may make people feel safer to disclose personal information, it at the same time constrains our ability to see immediate emotional responses to what was being said. This is a screenshot of a Google Hangout group chat illustrating how an interview might take place using synchronous technologies. I have used text chat for interviews myself, and I found that the typing speed of the participants plays a critical role in how much data can be gathered, especially during a predefined period of time. Interviewing via text chat does also eliminate the need for transcription and supports the ability to ask follow-up questions and probe for details, but it also requires patience and a good deal of time to get the depth of responses required. This is a screenshot that we created for a book in which my colleague Jessica and I are participating in a Skype video call. We are able to hear and see each other in real time and can also engage in text chat. The text chat channel becomes particularly important as you add additional people into the call. In fact, when using such a tool for a focus group, plans should be made to capture the text chats for analytic purposes. I use this kind of technology when I teach online courses, and I find that what happens in the chat window is usually much more interesting than what's happening in the face-to-face conversations. In some ways, video conferencing captures the best of both the synchronous and asynchronous technologies. In the journal Qualitative Health Research, Fox and her colleagues discussed their use of synchronous focus groups with young people who had chronic skin diseases or skin conditions. They noted the fast-moving, dynamic nature of the interaction, and they noted that this modality was especially appealing to young people who are used to this kind of conversation, texting and instant messaging and the kind of less coherent conversations. The researchers felt that the participants' use of emoticons and text-based abbreviations made up to some extent for the lack of visual cues that we usually find in text-based environments. However, finding a common meeting time for the potential participants can be difficult. A fast internet connection is needed so as not to be dropped from the chat, and not all of the participants will necessarily show up, so they recommended over-recruiting. The turn-taking in these groups can be somewhat chaotic, and those with faster typing speeds are going to wield more power in that they can contribute more to the conversation. So they actually recommended that for more than five participants, you have two moderators. So to sum up this first section on online interviews and focus groups, these are some highlights from decision-making checklists created by Wilkerson and colleagues on selecting online data collection methods. They recommended, for example, taking into consideration the technical requirements for both the participants and the researchers, such as fast internet connection, access to a webcam. Writing skills are very important when you're using asynchronous technologies, whereas typing speed's more important for synchronous ones. While visual cues are largely absent in asynchronous forums, they are present in video conferencing and instant chat. The participants in asynchronous discussions can ignore messages, just simply not respond, lurk, and there can be a long lag time between when questions are asked and answers come online. In contrast, synchronous interviews and focus groups can seem almost chaotic as the number of participants increase, but more spontaneous responses with the ability to probe are possible in synchronous conversations, with asynchronous conversations providing usually more depth and more reflection. Next, we turn to the use of online communities and social media as sites for data collection. It is no longer breaking news that many, many Americans have a social media presence. As of September 2013, the Pew Research Center found that 73% of all internet users engage in some form of social media or social networking. I personally have continued to find Dana Boyd and Nicole Ellison's 2007 definition of social networking sites to be helpful in understanding this new form of community. Social networking sites, they explain, are web-based services that allow individuals to construct a public or semi-public profile, articulate a list of other users, sometimes known as friends, with whom they share a visible connection, and then to see the connections and activities of everyone else in the network. Boyd noted that it was only with the influx of commercial interest to social networking sites that sparked the term social media, with sites now being organized around a news feed of constantly updated information rather than around the profiles of the users. Even 27% of senior users are using social networks during their time online. It can be helpful to think about online communities and social networks as either spontaneous or designed. Spontaneous communities are those such as whiteblaze.net that I mentioned earlier, the online hobby group for thru-hikers, and many Facebook groups. These are peer-initiated groups begun by a group of people to meet their own needs. They tend to have a lot of participants and high levels of engagement, though who the participants are exactly is sometimes unknown, as it is not uncommon for participants to use pseudonyms or avatars in the case of Second Life. Design communities are just that, created by an organization or a sponsor to meet a perceived need, after which participants are recruited to join the group. Examples include Patients Like Me, which Paul will be discussing, 1,000 Voices, a project which aims to collect, display, and analyze life stories from people with disabilities. In design groups, participants may often be known, if not by everybody, but then at least by the organization sponsoring the groups. And at lunch today, one of your colleagues made a great point, which is that there's also a third type, which is the ones that look like they're peer-initiated, but they're really designed. You just don't really know who's behind them. So that is definitely a good point to be aware of. In my own research, I use discourse analysis methodologies with naturally occurring conversational data in these groups. I've looked at participation in both spontaneous and designed online groups, such as the White Blaze hiking community, online grief support groups, and online courses, with the goal of better understanding how people use language to construct the social realities of the community, of community membership, of grief, and of learning for each of those projects. This is an example of an online support group for people with diabetes. The site Daily Strength hosts over 500 support groups with the tagline, "Free anonymous support from people just like you." In this post, Frisk, a little starfish is the avatar there, it's likely not a real name, discusses his high glucose and cholesterol levels as well as his use of Lipitor. So that second paragraph says, "So I went to my family doctor to refill my prescription for my blood pressure medicine and he decided to do some blood work. My cholesterol was a little high, so he prescribed 10 milligrams of Lipitor. But the thing that scares me the most was my elevated glucose level. It was 118. The doctor said it should be between 65 and 105. I now have to go take a 2-hour glucose tolerance test." So he goes on and talks about his confusion around this and whether there's some other issues that the test will uncover. And I forgot to count exactly how many responses he got, but he got a good number of people engaging him in conversation around his questions. Online communities are sites where people are discussing their symptoms, treatments, and experiences of care, and would seem to be a useful sort of data, a useful source of data for understanding patient-reported outcomes. This is a thread from a diabetes support group on Facebook. So similar idea, different tool, where a question from a fan is shared, and this one received 148 replies. The question is, I was wondering if any fellow pumpers get a lot of infections at the infusion site that requires strong antibiotic or even lancing and packing. How often? I'm getting them every 2 to 3 months. I'm really discouraged. And the third response there says, I use Omnipod and you have to change it every 3 days. My Medtronic sites used to get irritated when I used it, but not with Omnipod. So that's just a little sample of the discussions that are going on. And lastly, we turn to Twitter, which is not exactly an online community in the same way that the other sites are. It's a very active social media site, though, with the simple use of a hashtag, you can connect what you're sharing with everybody else who has shared on that same topic. This screenshot is a result of a search I did for Medtronic, since that came up in the previous community. And so I went ahead to see what was being talked about here. So it gives you an idea of some of the different tweets that come up. And what I thought was interesting is we see a link to the Instagram photo, which my freshmen tell me is the only social media site the young kids are using these days. They're done with Facebook. Some of them use Twitter, but they're really into Instagram. And so if you click, let me see if I can do this. If you click on this Instagram link that I've circled here, it takes you to a picture, maybe, we'll see, of, oh. How do I switch to that on here? I can see it on my computer. This is always the...
I think we need
tea. This is, well, when you click on it, it brings up her Instagram site where you can see a picture of her skin with the rash, the picture that she took when she removed the pump. So it's very easy quickly to see exactly what was going on. Now the question is, did I get myself out? Oh, here we go. Okay. Health researchers have already been using social media in various ways. Prieto and colleagues in Spain reported on a method in which they were able to extract and classify over 13,000 tweets that referenced flu, pregnancy, depression, and eating disorders. They were able to track the presence and development of each issue across Spain in almost real time. A similar study, I imagine, could be done tracking patient experiences and outcomes from various medical interventions. McGregor and colleagues scraped, and I'll explain what that means later, 5 social media platforms to examine their use by patients with glaucoma. They found that patients talked the most about treatments and about their experience of care. As you could see in the screenshots, these sites are, in essence, where people are already talking about their experience of medical condition and the outcomes of their treatments. Finally, O'Connor and colleagues used Twitter to recruit participants for their online survey on the experiences of mothers of advanced maternal age. A total of 529 mothers accessed the survey and 299 completed it over the course of 11 weeks. This shows how Twitter can be used to engage research participants in questionnaires and surveys on a variety of topics. Issues to consider. The big issue here with the use of social media or other online communities as a source of data is, of course, ethical approaches to access. Web scraping, mentioned earlier, is also known as web harvesting or web data extraction. It's the practice of using software, sometimes in conjunction with bots, to extract information from websites and social media. However, this is not always done with the consent of the people whose data is being extracted, or even of the owners of the website. Keep in mind that these conversations among the users of YouTube, Twitter, and to some extent Facebook are publicly visible, making it incredibly easy to access, extract, and analyze. And at my university, completely exempt from even expedited IRB review because anything that's publicly available on the web is considered like a newspaper, which I don't think we would all necessarily agree with, but it's good to know that. One major qualitative data analysis software company, in fact, QSR and Vivo, recently released its Encapture tool, which was designed specifically to enable the extraction of Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and YouTube data into a highly organized and easily analyzable format, as illustrated here. This practice does lead us into some ethically ambiguous territory. McKee and Porter, in their book, The Ethics of Internet Research, provide this heuristic to help guide researchers to decide whether or not they should obtain informed consent. So as you can see, the more public the data, the higher the topic sensitivity, the more likely you are to interact with those, like ask them to do a survey, and the more vulnerable the subject, the more likely you should ask for informed consent. Finally, mobile devices. Just like previously, a lot of people have cell phones, and increasingly more and more of us have smartphones, including older adults. And if we don't have cell phones or smartphones, we have e-readers or tablets. And I would argue most of us are not actually using our cell phones to call people anymore. We're using them to do a variety of other activities. Some previous research studies have looked at mobile devices in terms of motion sensors, which would take developing specific apps to use the mobile sensors in the device to detect behavior and activity, and then use that to trigger surveys be sent to the participants. Text messaging and SMS prompts are sent to participants. And then finally, more and more phones are being used for assisted interviewing. And the next three slides are just examples of the screenshots. This is one to remind patients to take glucose measurement. This is one that asks them to gather information about participant activities. And finally, one to track caloric intake. Whoops. Okay, so of course the issues with mobile apps and mobile phones really is around data privacy. The increasing ubiquity of sensors that are around us, on us, and in us, as Chandler has said, create seemingly endless data streams for mobile monitoring and other innovations. But what are the implications for data privacy and security? Just like you all are dealing with HIPAA regulations, we in education are dealing with FERPA. It makes us think carefully about how we access, manage, and analyze our sources of data. So all three types of the data today raise important questions. How does the use of technology impact our sampling strategies, the quality of our data, the conclusions and claims that we can make? In educational research, our mission is to do whatever it takes to reach our learners, to provide access to quality learning experiences and environments, and to try our best to find out what works and what doesn't. And increasingly, what this requires us to do is to use the same tools that our learners are already using in order to meet them where they are. And then in closing, go ahead and get out your smartphones. They would take away my educator credential if I did not get some instant feedback from the learners. Which one of these data collection methods has the most immediate relevance for the work that you do? And you can simply text one of those three codes to 22333, and we should get a sense of which of those three types of data resonated the most. Oh, sorry. You just open a your whatever text messaging program you use, and you text to 22333 is who you send the text message to, and you pick one of those numbers for which data type. So right now, mobile devices is in the lead. Well, I think I'm out of time, so thank you very much, and hopefully this was helpful to present an overview of data collection and digital tools.
Right, well, very sorry to be interrupting the data collection exercise. So my name is Paul Wicks. I'm a neuropsychologist by training, and I've been using the internet to conduct research and lead focus groups since about 2002. And of course, the internet is in dog years, so really that's about 50 years of experience I've gathered in that time. And really my job has been to try and make working on the internet credible. Because as we all know, and I'm sure many people have been thinking about this in the back of their minds, you know, the plural of anecdote is not data. And for many clinicians especially, the idea of a patient showing up who's read something on the internet is actually a cause for anxiety and alarm that there's a lot of bad stuff out there. I think that's a very outdated model of the world. I think things have moved on a great deal, and we have to look at the rapid evolving pace of technology to see that actually the patient advocacy movement have actually taken a lot of these tools and accelerated past where even the scientific fields have been. And to some extent, it's up to our collective responsibility to play catch up to where the patients have actually got to. So today I'm going to show you a little bit about one of the tools we've been developing on Patients Like Me. Just so you know, we're a for-profit company. We don't have any advertising or any fees for users. We predominantly make revenue by doing research for the pharmaceutical industry as well as grants that we get. So the idea of Patients Like Me is it combines elements of a social networking site with something like a registry or a clinical trial or something like that. Patients come to the system with a specific condition. For a variety of reasons, we started off in neurological conditions. We were founded by a family affected by ALS. That's how I came across them. My PhD was in ALS. Now I used to run the main message board for patients with ALS in the UK. So in this tool, people can come and create a profile of data. And it's not just stories and cat pictures. It's actually fed by medical databases. So the drugs that are there come from Multnom database. The symptoms are coded in ICF and MedDRA and SNOMED. We have teams of nurses and pharmacists that code all the data so that it can be aggregated and structured with a view of being able to do research with this data. So by using the system, the breadcrumbs of information that patients use as they track their data over time, interact with other patients and learn from one another can actually be used to, for that altruistic purpose of doing research as well. We have some evidence to suggest, and there'll be something coming out about this at AAN tomorrow, that actually patients connecting with one another actually improves their outcomes in terms of improved understanding of their self-efficacy, their self-management, and even just connecting with other patients to learn tips about living well with their disease. And we believe this creates a virtuous cycle that encourages them to submit more data. So the way we really came into patient-reported outcomes, as a researcher, I used to go and field lots of questionnaires to people. I was a neuropsychologist, so I'd give them big batteries of tests, you know, many of them normed on white middle-class undergraduate students in universities to then go and deploy to a completely different population. So very glad to see that we've put a lot of focus now on making sure that tools are available for the right population. And where we started out in ALS, we were actually very lucky. If you ever worked in that rare and awful disease, there's a tool called the ALS Functional Rating Scale that in 12 questions asks about speech, swallowing, walking, breathing. It's the gold standard in clinical trials, and the patient-reported version or the caregiver-reported version maps very, very highly to a clinician's impression. So when I came to Patients Like Me, what was really interesting and novel about it was this research tool, which I, as a scientist, I was forbidden from ever telling a patient what their score was. Because what the doctors told me was that's not your job to tell them that. It's not their business to know that. It's a research tool. You know, if you tell them they're a 44 out of a 48, they're going to say, well, how could I be a 43 or whatever? And we don't want to worry them about it. Patients Like Me threw that on its head and said, here's the instrument, and here's your graph over time. Now, a couple of times today, we've seen some conceptual diagrams of, you know, what an exacerbation looks like in COPD, or I'm sure you've seen charts of what MS looks like, you know, very spiky up and down. But actually, if you look at someone's record, it doesn't look like that. Looks like a bunch of text fields. Actually, let's be more specific. In America, it looks like a bunch of billing codes. And that doesn't really reflect the shape of the disease. So this is a curve of an ALS functional rating scale. And the patient, for the first time, this is back in 2006, at the same time Facebook was launching, quite revolutionary that a patient could see how they were doing, track that over time, and then the colors you can see in the background, those are percentile curves that shows the patient how they're doing relative to everybody else. Now, at the time that I was working at the hospital, we would tell people in terms of survival that most people with ALS live between 2 and 5 years. Now, some people live 1 year, some people live 10 years. And I think if it was you, you'd want to know which band you fell in. But it was not standard practice to tell people. And that's knowable with the 12 questions, right? It should be fairly simple. So the idea that you can give this back to patients and it'd be very powerful was a very interesting one. However, even that has its flaws. This is actually the profile of Stephen Haywood, who was the patient whose family set up Patients Like Me. And what you can see here is that he hit a zero on this scale. Stephen Hawking's about a zero, just for reference. And he was a zero for many, many years. And there was another patient, a lady called Kathy Wolf, she's the third author on this instrument here, who was incredibly frustrated that despite the fact that she could manage her household and be a grandmother and write poetry and be a patient advocate, she was counted as a zero. And you know, when I asked my clinical colleagues about this, they said, oh, she's bottomed out. And she was pretty mad about this. She wrote, I have not bottomed out. If there's some researcher out there that doesn't know how to measure the function of people on a ventilator, I'll help them. I'll come up with it. And in fact, now it's important to say, Kathy was a psychologist for 25 years at IBM doing human factors design. So when she comes across a scale she doesn't like, she doesn't just sit back and take it. So she actually co-authored with us an extension to the ALS functional rating scale. We actually did concept elicitation. And because we had the sickest patients, the people who are wheelchair bound, using communication technologies to use the web in these asynchronous methods, we actually reached the patients who are too sick to come to hospital, too sick to be in trials. Now, my PhD took me 3 years to see 100 patients. We got 200 in 2 weeks. And it was the sickest patients that were never normally counted. They're too sick to be in the trials. The other important detail, Kathy's quadriplegic. She did all of this with an eye tracking machine. Blink by blink by blink. And over the course of the hours it takes her to write emails and messages and all the rest of it, she actually acted as a co-PI on this project. And we were able to actually take these instruments and map out, for instance, the existing scale said if you can't write or speak, you can't communicate. If you have a spouse, you will know that a glance can communicate thousands of words. The same is true for people with ALS. They can communicate with their loved ones through facial expressions and other things. And so we published this, and it was quite interesting that it'd be patient-led. This is in about 2009, I think this was. But we've actually gone I'd never been to Isoqual or ISPOR. I didn't know anything about instrument development. This scale has been reused. It's actually the standard measure used by the VA now in their biobank, because the patients they see are all, obviously, their spine and brain is donated at autopsy, so people are very, very sick at the time that they pass away. And actually, this scale allows you to continue seeing changes after the floor effects gone down. So very powerful early example to us that the platform could help us do some of the concept elicitation, and that patients themselves had more to contribute than just being, you know, subjects, just being data points. They could actually lead research and teach the researchers a thing or two. So we've talked a little bit today about some of the issues that are here. You know, I've heard the number earlier, and I've heard it before. There are 7,000 conditions. Nord and Eurordis reckon there are about 7,000 rare conditions that don't even have names. So, you know, we've really got to look at that. ProQualid estimates are about 1,000 instruments. And the truth is, just for many conditions, we just don't have a way of saying you are here on a scale of there to there. You know, frequently, it's particularly with rare genetic developmental conditions, things like that, you know, you just have a bunch of stuff going on, and we'll have to kind of monitor it, and there's not really a way of saying, oh, you got better, or here's how you do relative to other people. And this is knowable stuff, right? But when it's so expensive and it takes so long, and, you know, the world's experts in PRO are in this room, we don't have the resources until we have more scalable platforms to create, if we need them, 7,000 measures or 14,000 measures. And I think we should be able to do that. It feels like a problem we can solve with technology, given that, you know, Moore's law doubles processing power every 18 months or whatever it is, and more people are available. You know, people, once they get sick, spend a lot of time on the web, they're willing to get involved. There's some issues around licensing, which can be confusing. You know, we heard earlier this morning from Pfizer actually saying, you know, we had the gold standard, but for licensing reasons, other people couldn't use it. So what happens, 14 other standards, you know, propagate. And a lot of what we've been building on comes from the software world, where actually there's been an increasing movement towards openness, collaboration, copy left instead of copyright, and we're experimenting with ways that could actually potentially work here. One of the things that I always find as a forehead slapping experience is when measures fail to take account of new services that are available. So the screening measure for whether you have Asperger's syndrome asks you whether or not you line up video cassette tapes. Anyone still have video cassette tapes in their house? And yet, you know, if I wanted to go make the version 2 of that scale, I might get sued by the license holder. Or, you know, I might have to revalidate it because I need to prove that, you know, lining up DVDs has equivalence with lining up videos. I don't know, whatever. Or that, you know, people going and saying, oh, can you go out and do your grocery shopping as a role function or a mobility issue? Well, I get my groceries delivered, so what does that even mean? You know, we need to take more account of these things and be more rapidly adaptive to the things that people are doing. Otherwise, patients read the scales. We just did a study about whether or not people take part in clinical trials. One patient wrote, you know, the questionnaire was so stupid, I didn't want to trust these people to put drugs in my body. There's a credibility gap that we risk losing out here. So GitHub is kind of a model for what we're going to do. Obviously, it's the internet, so it involved cats. GitHub is a programmer's thing, and it's from the open software movement. So you may have heard of things like Linux, which is an open operating system. It's free, unlike Windows, which, you know, it's expensive, and you have to buy it, and you can't reverse engineer it. or Firefox, which is a web browser, which again, you know, it's not so proprietary and locked down. If you remember the internet browser wars like Internet Explorer and Netscape about 10 years ago, where we've got to now with a lot of things is to say, okay, if you make this piece of software and you make the code available, you make the recipe available, not just the cake, other people could reverse engineer it, they could patch it, they could help fix bugs that you haven't seen, they can sort of lend their spare time, their cognitive surplus to you know, making things better. What GitHub does is version control. So it says, if I make, you know, the software equivalent of this blueberry cupcake, and I call it the Paul Wicks blueberry cupcake, and you want to go and do one with sprinkles, this system will allow us to say, well, here are the ingredients that originated with the original recipe, here are the pieces that were added, do they both still work? Yes. Maybe someone else wants to go do green sprinkles. And we can see these pieces of code forking off from the original repository. And so people maintain some amount of sort of credit for particular lines of code, for, you know, I'm the person that added this or that or what have you. But it also allows a much wider group of people to take part in that. And the reason that's interesting, you know, we actually heard today several times, a lot of the experts that develop this field are retiring, or they're leaving. Or sometimes a company changes ownership three times in the course of developing one instrument. These are all things that may complicate what we want to do years, decades down the line. And we, you know, heard earlier, sometimes we're using instruments from 1972. When you go and look at that, you have to figure out who's going to possibly sue you if that's happening. And I actually think that freeing up a lot of the license stuff and making money at other places, doing fees at other places for services, may make a lot more sense than this. So what we've done, and this has been funded with a generous grant, it's about $4.5 million from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, to build an open research exchange, which takes some of the promise of using a system like that, honors what's been done in the past by this PRO community, and brings in some of the more futuristic elements of social networking, plus a theme of patient advocacy pulled all the way through it. So what we've built is a PRO builder or a measure builder. We can argue about whether what we do is really PROs or not, as it doesn't go all the way through to endpoints. But it includes versioning, branching, tracking of the contributions, and a ton of feedback, more feedback than you could possibly ever handle, which is one of the things we're having to learn how to filter. But it also contains a social architecture, so that, for instance, a group of researchers can collaborate. You know, your RA can type in the questions, and the PI can come and check them, and then someone else can, you know, someone at another university can come and add in this question or whatever. And we can actually do this as a group, as opposed to sending around versions of Word with track changes. Everyone suffered from versionitis with PROs, right? So let's actually do this in the space where the instrument's happening. Statistics do not have to be scary. What we're interested in is lowering the barriers to do this. I mean, you know, you don't have to be a cartographer to use Google Earth and Google Maps and see the amazing sort of GIS systems that they have. Well, why can't I hook in Cronbar's Alpha into the survey results as they're coming in real time? Why can't I look at the item response theory curves as we're going in? So instead of us just having like a philosophical debate about which item's best and wait until we run it through a biostatistician who takes a few weeks to come back to it, why don't I just press refresh and we'll see it every time another 100 patients comes in through the door? Wouldn't that allow us to focus on what we're best at, having the arguments rather than worrying about logistics? And then what we want to create is a library where this data is accessible to the people who want to see it. So it's no longer just, I want to go and use this instrument, what did the publication say? Maybe it's, I want to use this instrument, what did the data say? And can I slice it and dice it? Can I see, okay, here's how it did in African Americans, here's how it did in females, here's how it did in adults or seniors. So you're not just looking at the aggregate data, you can get down to the item level data and actually see it there. Again, it's not that hard. It's just a different model. And then, you know, what we've increasingly tried to do is bring in scientific support to make sure we're trying to do this in the right way. So I mentioned about sort of honoring the work that's gone before. You know, we've got a great advisory board. Many of these names will be familiar to you. We're very lucky to have people like David Seller involved from the Promise Group. Ethan Bash has done a great deal of work in PROs. I mentioned this patient theme. Sarah Regare is a young woman with Parkinson's disease. She's a very prominent patient advocate. Hugh Hempel has two young children with developmental conditions. So, you know, we're trying to take advantage of a lot of what's gone before, and I think we're trying to build that in. So we have these sort of modules where we're actually building out things like concept elicitation in a structured, repeatable way. So you're not having to reinvent the wheel every time. We have feedback phases built in throughout the whole development cycle. And then once it's actually there, because we've got populations of, in many cases, thousands or tens of thousands of patients, it's possible to field things, change them, iterate on them, and then field them again. Because we have an engaged population of people that are coming back because they want to see their friends or track their progress, we can also do test retests more reliably. And so we can look for changes over time in a way that doesn't add massive additional marginal costs to the logistics of things. We've done a couple of experiments in online concept elicitation, and two of our collaborators are here, just to talk about some examples of where we've been working with sponsors in this type of area. So actually, with Margaret's group, we've been looking at CLL, and this is actually some work we've also been doing with HRA as another group of experts here. Obviously, this is a rare group of people with very serious condition. We're able to recruit these patients fairly rapidly through the web, and through predominantly open text guided probes, we're able to get good senses of the symptoms that were going on. We were curious to test, and actually Electra put this challenge to us last year at ISPOR, is the data as good as through traditional methods? And so for a subset of those users, we actually went back and asked them to do telephone interviews as well. And basically the preliminary conclusion from that is that concept saturation can be achieved through the online methods. But I think it's still sensible to double check with a subset. Another group, and this is with Katarina Halling's group at AstraZeneca, have been looking at ovarian cancer. Again, a difficult condition, some sensitive issues going on there, and we've been able to figure out an awful lot of what patients' journeys, patients' experiences are like from a sort of tangible group of people here. So we use both quantitative and qualitative feedback throughout the item level development, and so this allows us to get sort of a mixed methods view of things. We've got here some of the structured, repeatable questions that we get every time, and then underneath we have just a couple of examples of sort of open text. It's important to say we actually got a publication we're submitting for this new upcoming special issue of Quality of Life Research about new methods. And we've developed about 8 pilot PROs in the first year of the project. We've had input from 7,500 patients in that time. You know, patients are out there. Patients want to give you this this data. They want to give you feedbacks like, what does restless mean? It means something different to me than it might to you. You know, we've certainly had many cases where researchers can't help but use $3 words when a $1 word will do. And sometimes, again, it's just the blind spots of things like, well, when you ask me if, as a diabetic, I have this problem with food, the way you've asked that question is offensive to me. And sometimes as clinicians and scientists, we don't always think about that lived experience of it. But we've all filled out bad forms that we hate. So we've also asked at the end of each question some more patient-centric questions. Does this survey give you any insights into your own health condition? Increasingly, we feel that these measures are going to be used by patients to track themselves over time. So not just the clinical use. Doctors do not have a great deal of time to administer these things in the clinic, but patients do have a lot more time to decide whether or not they want to use these things and track themselves over time. We learned from the OMERACT group to have a great deal of respect for the work they've done, as well as iSpy, and specifically asking, are there any blind spots the researcher has missed here, has illuminated a number of issues that our collaborators have actually built into their instrument. And they've been surprised, they've actually said, wow, I did not expect that this would be the type of thing I'd be learning from this process. So this is a prototype view. Some of this is in development. So everything I've shown you so far is in process. This is a kind of a view of the type of real-time psychometric stats. So this is a design in pixels, not in code yet. But the thing about this, and the thing that's a bit different to think about from, say, telephones or focus groups, this system gets better every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, 4 weeks, something like that. So it's evolving much more rapidly than other typical methods here. So as a researcher, as someone who's developed this instrument, I can see what are my floor effects, what are my ceiling effects, what are the distribution of scores, how might I have this discussion with my colleagues in real time to decide how things are going off. Maybe if there's a large enough available sample, I'm realizing something's completely wrong, we've used the wrong options, it may be okay to say, okay, well, we're gonna lock off this version, make a new version, then go see if we can get a completely fresh sample of people to see if I compare the curves of these two instruments, how are we doing? So, just to finish and summarize here, and maybe I'll leave this up, I do want to certainly be clear there are plenty of limitations here, and page that we've published about 50 papers. I've gotten really good at writing the limitations sections of these papers because that's where the reviewers really want to pick you out. What I'd say is this is a double-edged sword. The best things about using the internet are the worst things about using the internet, and you just have to accept that that's what it is. Yes, it's very participatory. It's great having input from hundreds and hundreds of patients, but you know what? You'd better read that. Because if you don't, the patient's going to be very, very upset with you and very disenfranchised, and you're going to harm that relationship that we have. Speed is great. You will feel much stupider for sending out a form with a typo to 10,000 people than you do to 100 people in the mail. Anonymity is a great strength. I think where we are going to get a lot of great things is asking about sensitive, difficult, embarrassing topics. Or getting people who are too sick or who have issues around that. But there is some validation. One of the things we've been working on is asking people, can we access their medical records? In the pilot that we did, 80% of patients were happy for us to contact their physician. Now, when we're asking 7,500 patients, I can't ask 7,500 doctors. But 5, 10 years out, can I have their EMR authorization? to say, oh yeah, you can have my tick mark that I have MS or something like that. I think we're moving to a future towards that. And then I'll just quickly say the last one then, I think that we really have to get towards is a global reach. You know, we have at least one patient on every country on Earth, and right now our focus for a variety of reasons is in English-speaking, US markets, that type of thing, but I think ultimately we have to find ways that get across that. It's a bit of a space shuttle problem. The longer we leave it, the easier it'll probably be. If I do nothing, Google will probably solve this problem for us in the next 3 to 5 years. But, you know, medical translation is hard. Chinese word for nausea is headache. And in an area where we submit our adverse events to the FDA and things like that, we need to be really careful about that. But I'm hugely optimistic that, you know, technology offers one possible avenue of not doing the whole thing, but maybe shortening some of these 1-2 year chunks. Most of what the work I showed you took days or weeks, not months or years to come back. And that this may be something that you can use as one tool in the toolbox, but I do really think it's got a great advantage of being a little bit faster and of making it easier for patients to more systematically provide their input in a volume that allows them to speak to you and help them to improve the work that you're doing. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Trina and Paul. Right now, we'd like to move on to the responses. And first of all, we'll hear from Electra.
I, too, would like to thank Trina and Paul for excellent presentations. I found these to be really eye-opening presentations about the possibilities out there and how we might start to harness this technology. One thing I thought was really valuable from your presentation, Trina, was the framework of the different types of qualitative data that are out there. You showed researcher-generated, naturally occurring, and community versus designed online sites, synchronous versus asynchronous, and I think this is the very type of lexicon that we need to be using when we're looking how to move forward and matching the type of tool we're using for a particular application. So this was another challenge, I think, from last year, is to sort of develop the lexicon, and I think we're making progress there. So that's exciting. And of course, we're very interested in new ideas and ways to increase efficiency in PRO development. I think we're beginning to answer some of the questions and concerns. In addition to content validity for PRO instruments, even though that was the subject of this session, I can see applications of this technology in patient input efforts, even proximal to the start of instrument development, but in finding out what concepts are important to patients. And we've heard this theme expressed earlier in this meeting. I think the most important question that needs to be addressed is the question of who we're talking to when we use the social media and instrument development. Of course, a key principle of instrument development is conducting research in the target population in which the instrument will be eventually used. So we like to know information, you know, confirmation of the diagnosis, any important subsets, the demographics, you know, even things such as ethnicity and language, concomitant illnesses that might affect how we interpret the patient's experiences. So these are all things that we look at in the traditional methodologies, and I'm hoping we can start to address in using the newer methods. So, and it's promising to see, Paul, from your research that the majority of patients in participating and patients like me would consent to have their physicians contacted. So that's good to, very good to hear. And then another point is the context in which social media is leveraged is also important. So are we using the social media, for example, for hypothesis generation early on in terms of when we're first developing the instrument conceptual framework and we're gathering expert input and literature review? You know, how can social media be used in that early stage versus the later stage of instrument development, development of items and cognitive interviews and things like that? So I think the type of qualitative data would need to be matched to the specific use. Probably I see more utility in the researcher-generated method because it seems to be more closely in alignment with traditional methods for documenting content validity, you know, by prospectively allowing us to sample patients with disease in the target population, perhaps allowing open-ended questions and the ability to follow up with probes to those questions. So I think this is something to consider. And another consideration is ability to match the quotes of the individual to the characteristics of that individual. You mentioned use of Skype, and I think this would be really useful to allow researchers to reach hard-to-reach populations in diverse locations, particularly important for rare diseases, I think. You mentioned time and cost savings, which are critical. So I think this has been a great dialogue. With regard to web scraping or web harvesting or data extraction, you mentioned that we don't, this isn't done with the consent of the people, so it may raise ethical issues. And also there are some issues around, you know, when we're doing the scraping, what are we getting and what might we be missing? That's really all I have. I think this has been really eye-opening.
Thank you, Sarah. So thank you both for your excellent presentations, and I've learned a lot along the way. So from my perspective and what we've done at Pfizer, I think in the early 2000s we were asynchronous. We trialed doing some online interviews, and that helped not only us, but the wider team could view it as it was rolling, and we could also ask the moderator to ask specific questions and go more in depth. However, as we've moved forward with PRO development and the focus on context of use and content validity being constrained to the population that you're treating in your clinical trial, and that need for a confirmed diagnosis, which I think you've just confirmed again, is still required, it makes using social media like this problematic. It's not that we don't want to innovate in this space, and these pros and cons are some of the things that we clearly all recognize, but given we need that confirmed diagnosis, I suppose the way we've moved forward is to try and do a bit of both, is to have the in-depth interview with patients who we know have the condition with the inclusion-exclusion criteria akin to our clinical trials, but then we can get more. And I think in this mixed methods position we're in currently, where we need to be doing IRT, this may well be a way forward of getting quick numbers of patients to have a quick look-see, and I like the idea of the refresh button. So, you know, I think we just need to do more to show that it is viable, and to convince the regulators that this is a viable way forward, and to use that mixed approach in the and also I think back to the we've used it around unmet medical need as well to find out what the patient's real needs are in the context. So less so for developing PROs, but more. We developed a website in the UK to get it UK chronic pain patients, and it was almost like a blog that they could go on and describe daily what they were experiencing, and we could monitor that and look to see how that was fluctuating and what the concerns were at day to day. So I think we are trialing, well, we have been trialing things in industry. Be great to hear from some other companies, not just me. I think it's a work in progress.
Thank you, all of you. Really appreciate your contributions. Does anyone have any questions at this point? Well, I'm going to ask a question if no one else has a question. You know, both of these talks were really exciting and very informative, especially for someone such as myself who's extremely naive about these things. But Tara does bring up a good point, and how are we going to deal with the issue that we still have these serious constraints on one side, and we have all this exciting technology on the other side? So what do you have suggestions for how we might move forward in this context?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting, and it was to the point earlier, where these measures aren't just used as endpoints. And you know, we heard the point earlier about, say, where in the old days, a clinical tool that was perhaps made up on the back of a napkin at a conference in Hawaii around a swimming pool suddenly becomes a clinical trial outpoint. Maybe there's a different view now that could happen. Whereas if actually a large proportion of patients, you know, can help develop tools systematically and have shown the different thresholds that are viable, then perhaps that can actually become the. So if there is no tool in Duchenne's, why can't the parents develop the first pass at it? And actually, this year we've got two instruments funded by RWGF that will be developed by patients. And that's really a challenge to us to make the software so self-service that it can kind of say, oh, yes, well, you got concept elicitation from a demographic that, you know, does map the what the population is like, and yes, you got this many symptom terms, and yes, there's enough of this. It should be possible to do this type of stuff, so that at least then when it wants to get picked up and taken, if there's a sponsor, if there's an interest, if there's a drug, they can say, well, gosh, the groundwork has been laid here, and it becomes more a question of translating and validating rather than sort of creating things from whole cloth, so that, you know, we're actually, the ball's rolling a little bit. But each disease has its own culture, and if we can help, you know, plant the seeds of measurement and the rigors of measurement in every condition that's out there, rare or common, then hopefully those little seedlings will sort of grow everywhere. In some places more than others, you know, and there's some places where it doesn't need it as much as others. But like I said, I'll just go back to those thousands of diseases that just have no measurement at all, and that, you know, just planting those seeds must be better than what we have now, which is very close to nothing.
Electra, do you have a response?
So as I'm not sure I have a specific response to you, but as I was listening to the talks, you know, it occurred to me how these might be used in natural history studies. And I know that there's some very well-organized databases in the area of cystic fibrosis, where essentially every patient who has a diagnosis is plugged in to this database, and we're able to see their, you know, their natural history, their trends over time. It's extremely useful, and so I think, you know, that's an important application of social media as well.
Did you have a question? Okay. Okay. Great.
Jason Gold with Covance. Paul, my reference to this question is my PhD is in clinical psychology. I also was a neuropsychologist for a bit, very small bit. Part of administration of, say, the WISC is the clinical component to it, the watching the behaviors of the patient or student as they are completing the questionnaire. As a moderator for focus groups, I find this same bit of information invaluable. And I'm not so worried about what patients say through a media where I'm not physically watching them. I'm worried about what they're not saying. And I realize that through the anonymous feedback, you might get some information that you might not otherwise. But I'm still not sure that we have the ability to capture the uncomfortable parts of the conversation and bits like that. And you mentioned a validation study, which I was excited to hear about, but then you said via telephone, and I kind of lost it there. I'm wondering, you know, can you do a validation? Has there been any work with this where you've looked at physical focus groups, live focus groups, et cetera? If you can just comment on those.
Yeah,
thank you.
So I think telephone in that particular instance, and some of my colleagues from HRA are here, I think that was more to do with the fact that the group we were looking for were quite rare patients to get a hold of. And it seemed like an easier first step to at least, you know, do something that's known. I take your point entirely about the sort of nonverbal communication bit. And yes, it is the people struggling with the instructions or going or getting really angry at the question, whatever. I think there's a different set of things that go with that. So for instance, in every question that we have, even when it's in the draft phase to when it's ready for testing, there's always a button that says, I want to skip this question, or this is a dumb question. It doesn't quite say that. And I think those statistics, as they come up, will be useful. There's also other things that we can get more objectively. So for instance, we can tell how long someone is thinking and pausing about that question in seconds, right, tracked with timers on the web. And the what does this mean quotient can now be objective. It can be measurable in units that physics appreciates, you know, like not like fuzzy social scientists like us. And so there may just be other ways that we can get at things, such as, you know, time, the number of times people say there's an inappropriate question or what have you. But no, I absolutely take your point. I think particularly, you know, how are people going to interpret smiley faces in concept of, you know, if someone says, oh, it's really difficult seeing my doctor and talking about this odd thing, lol, smiley face. I'm not sure we need a PRO industry guidance document on how to interpret the emoticons. But, you know, we have to sort of acknowledge it, depending on what condition you're talking about. You know, we looked at that segment of the thing you showed from Pew. I mean, the other way of thinking about this is junior doctors. A doctor graduating med school today has never lived in a time without instant answers to everything in the universe on their smartphone. And the same is true of patients being diagnosed with MS this week. You know, the expectations of the place in which these things live have really changed, and they will want, the patients will want us to hew to their culture rather than the other way around. But yes, we would be certainly interested if there are people that would like to try those experiments. There's a bit of upfront work that needs to continue to be done. In terms of validation, you know, I used to work in conditions like ALS where it was a clinical diagnosis, but we still got things wrong. So even having a doctor saying, hey, this guy's got ALS, that's a different level of confidence from a doctor saying, hey, this person's got ME, or fibromyalgia, or depression, right? So even that gold standard is a bit fuzzy. There may be places we can get in between. If you can take a photo of your smartphone of your prescription for Copaxone with your name and address on it, should we take that as evidence? If I can take a snapshot of your Quest Diagnostics lab that says your HIV viral load is here, is that a level of evidence? I think it's not likely to just be one answer to say, yes, this person is John Smith and they are who they say they are and this is their diagnosis. It's probably going to be a series of pieces of evidence converging together that will get easier as these data sources become as ubiquitous as online banking is or online travel agents or what have you over the coming decade.
Well, I want to say thank you again. It looks like there are tremendous opportunities here, so let's go forward.
Thank you, Margaret. Now we will take a 20-minute break, so everybody, please be back in your seats at 4 o'clock. Thanks.